From NPR News, this is a special edition of Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. The rising cost of food has set off protests from Haiti to Egypt, and there is no sign things will get easier anytime soon. In this series, we will hear from NPR's foreign correspondents about how rising food prices are hitting the countries they cover. We'll begin our series here in Washington, where the U.S. government and international aid agencies are trying to figure out how to cope with the problem. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman reports.
The World Food Program's executive director, Josette Sheeran, has spent much of her first year on the job talking about the perfect storm in the world food market: low food reserves, rising energy prices, and a high demand for biofuels.
I think, in a way, we're the canary in the cave, because very early on, we begin to see vulnerability coming that is affecting people that make less than a dollar a day. So about a year ago, I began to talk about the perfect storm forming for the world's most vulnerable. I thought it would take a couple of years, but I think we're in the eye of the storm now.
The price of rice is up about 70% since last year, and the price of wheat has more than doubled. Sheeran says the World Food Program just can't buy enough food.
So now our cup in school for kids can be filled 40% less than it could just 8, 9, 10 months ago.
Earlier this year, she appealed for an extra $500 million, but now says she needs $700 million. Sheeran met late Friday with the director of U.S. Foreign Assistance, Henrietta Fore.
The United States usually gives between 40 and 50% of the world food donations. And we would anticipate that we would be in that range again, but the prices are skyrocketing for all of us.
Fore sent a $350 million supplemental budget request to Congress before the food prices shot up.
We've also asked for local purchase authority, which would allow our United States dollars to stretch further. When we can purchase on local markets, it also encourages local farmers to produce food. It allows the food to get there more quickly.
Experts believe prices will remain high for several years. Some countries are responding by capping food prices or limiting exports to keep enough food for their own people. Siwa Msangi of the International Food Policy Research Institute says he's worried these actions will distort the market. He says it's time for rich and poor nations to have a real discussion about how to fix all this.
That's going to put the burden on policymakers and on the world community, really, to look closely at trade policies, to look closely at technology policies, and put everything on the table.
Water and population policy should also be on the table, according to Lester Brown, author of the book Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization.
My principal concern about this is the effect it will have on social unrest and political stability in the low and middle income countries in the world that import a substantial share of their grain supply. These countries are in trouble now.
Unlike previous spikes in food prices caused by crop failures, Brown says we're dealing with systemic changes now. Rising demand in Asia, for instance, for more grain-intensive livestock. But he says the straw that broke the camel's back is the demand for biofuel.
The grain required to fill a 25-gallon SUV tank with ethanol will feed one person for a year. And what we're seeing now is the emergence of direct competition between the 860 million people in the world who own automobiles and who want to maintain their mobility, while the 2 billion poorest people in the world simply want to survive.
Brown says he's starting to hear a debate once again about the predictions by 18th century demographer Thomas Malthus that the world's population will outgrow its food supply. But U.S. officials brush off such talk. The World Food Program's Josette Sheeran also remains optimistic.
I have not yet met an expert who doesn't believe the world can produce more food. And so I am a long-term optimist, i.e., over the next 5 or 10 years, we will figure this out.
In the meantime, her organization is scrambling to help those hardest hit by the price hikes. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
In China, an old proverb has it that to the common people, food is as important as heaven. And that holds true today, even though the nation's eating habits are changing and even though there are now 1.3 billion mouths to feed. In the second part of our series on rising global food prices, NPR's Anthony Kuhn takes a look at the impact on China's food producers and consumers.
It's feeding time for the big pink pigs in farmer Zhu Shangzun's pen. With 200 hogs, he's one of the biggest pig farmers in his village on the outskirts of Beijing. Most of China's pigs are bred on small family-owned farms just like his. Zhu says prices for his pigs have more than doubled in the past couple of years, and he's clearing $70 in profit for each of the 30 pigs he sells every month. I doubt prices will rise further, he says. This is the most profitable time for us pig farmers, but I think this is as far as it's going to go. Pork is the main meat for most Chinese. In 2006, China produced over 50 million tons of pork, accounting for more than half of the world's total. And it consumes most of that itself. Rising pork prices have been a major factor in inflation, which reached nearly 5% last year, a level not seen here in more than a decade. One reason for the rising pork prices is a recent outbreak of blue ear disease, which decimated the hog population. Farmer Zhu cites another reason. It's because of the fuel issue, Zhu says. They make corn into ethanol, and it's cheaper than oil. But that drives up the price of the corn in our pig feed. China's leaders are worried about the political fallout from inflation, because inflation has historically been a factor in social unrest. In a bid to halt rising food prices, the government has limited the use of corn for making ethanol and introduced agricultural subsidies. Mr. Zhu gets subsidies worth around $14 for each pig. But Farmer Zhu's profits translate into grocery sticker shock for consumers like Li Shujuan. Li is a publishing house editor. She's making her daily trip to the market to buy meat and vegetables for dinner.
How is this price compared to, say, a year ago?
Well, much higher, almost double. That's why I bought this big rib. It's cost me 38. I was like, wow, so expensive.
There are lots of foods that weren't on sale here 10 or 20 years ago, and all of them command higher prices. There's a lot more lean meat. There are convenience foods like frozen dumplings and instant noodles. Li Shujuan remembers when she was a kid, she used to fight with her family members over who got the chicken drumsticks.
So at that time I thought, wow, if the chicken had more legs, so everyone can have one. But now you can see, the chicken, divided into different parts, so people can choose whatever they want.
Li goes home to prepare dinner. She knows that many poor people in China are being hit hard by inflation. They already spend most of their income on food, and now they have to cut back on their meat intake. She says that's not an option for her family.
You have to spend more money because you have to live in this way. We cannot say, okay, the prices, pork rises, and we won't eat it. Because all this is impossible because we need that for daily life. So the only things we have to, make more money to cover the expense. That's why we work hard. That's why we come back home late.
Foreign media often cite China's increasing consumption as a reason for higher global food prices. Nicholas Lardy, an economist with the Peterson Institute of International Economics in Washington, says that so far the statistics don't bear this out.
When you look at the trade data, China is a small exporter of food, but they're mostly exporting high value-added products, vegetables, and other things like that. They are importing huge quantities of soybeans, but they're not importing a lot of other grains like rice and wheat. And they don't transmit much of their higher prices for pork to the rest of the world.
China's leaders bristle at the suggestion that their country is exporting its inflation overseas, or that feeding China will ever become the world's problem. But it is clear that as Chinese people become more affluent, they'll be wanting more meats and more grains to feed their livestock. And so demand has nowhere to go but up. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
In a moment, more on the impact of food price hikes from Britain, Egypt, and Haiti.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
One of the factors in the growing price of food worldwide is the increasing use of farmland to grow food for fuel, or biofuel as it's known. A new law came into force in Britain this week that requires 2.5% of all gasoline and diesel sold for any vehicle in the country to come from biofuels. That will rise to 5% by 2010, and the European Union has proposed a target of 10% across Europe by 2020. While those targets had initially been criticized as a timid response to global warming, now there is some relief that the policies haven't gone further. In the third part of our series on the global food shortage, NPR's Rob Gifford reports from London.
£4.70, please.
The global food crisis has started to affect Bonnet's Bakery in the tiny town of Chatteris, just north of Cambridge in eastern England. Standing behind the counter serving wholesome wholemeal loaves is Valerie Shea.
The price of wheat's gone up, which affects the price of a loaf of bread. I'd say about 10-15% rise on a loaf of bread.
The trickle of customers into the bakery seem philosophical about the extra 40 or 50 cents on the cost of a loaf of bread, perhaps because, unlike most of the developing world where up to 80% of income can be spent on food, in Britain and much of Europe that figure is more like 10-15%. Europeans grumble a little, tighten their belts, cut down on luxuries and get on with it. But there's one group of Europeans who, for once, are not grumbling at all.
It'll just take a little bit of persuasion to get us started.
...47-year-old George Munns climbs on board his big green tractor on the 500 acres he farms just outside Chatteris. For decades, it's been tough for British farmers, as rock-bottom crop prices meant huge financial difficulties. But suddenly, in the last couple of years, with the rise in demand in China and India and poor harvests in places like Australia, all that has changed.
Wheat prices 3 years ago were around £60 a tonne. Now the spot price for wheat is around about £170.
That tripling of the price Munns gets for his wheat has revitalised his farm as a business. And it's meant that while a few years ago he and neighbouring farmers were looking at the possibility of growing crops for biofuels, now he's just not interested.
We won't do anything particularly to make biofuel here now, just because of it's just not worth it.
Britain has turned much less land over to biofuels than other European countries such as Germany. But still, only 2% of European agricultural land is used to grow such crops, compared to between 20 and 30% in the United States. So, spokesman on agriculture at the European Union in Brussels, Michael Mann, believes the EU is part of the solution to the world food shortage, not part of the problem.
We are seeing huge areas of land in countries that have recently joined the European Union coming into production that previously were left unplanted. We are also trying very hard to move to the second generation of biofuels, which don't use agricultural raw materials but use byproducts and waste products. And also we will import a certain amount of our needs. So we don't see that European Union biofuel policy will have a major effect on food prices or food availability.
John Alliston, Dean of the School of Agriculture at Britain's Royal Agricultural College, agrees. He says, of course, the world does need to find a replacement for burning fossil fuels. But in the current dilemma, he says, Europe should stick to its strengths.
In mainland Europe, we are good at producing food because of the climate we have and because of the rainfall we get. And so that's what I think we should be doing. And maybe other parts of the world that produce sugar perhaps might want to produce the energy.
The grim contradiction at the heart of this debate is that at present, at least, it seems impossible to move to greener ways of powering machines and simultaneously feed the world. Solving that contradiction is at the heart of what those in Europe and elsewhere are now trying to do. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Cambridgeshire, England.
Once the breadbasket of the Roman Empire, Egypt in recent months has seen large and occasionally violent crowds spending much of their day in lines outside government bakeries attempting to buy cheap, subsidized bread. Egyptians have long been known for their ability to shrug off adversity, but the current pressures are provoking strikes and demonstrations on a surprising scale. From Cairo, NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The bread line has become emblematic of the financial woes facing ordinary Egyptians. It also provides a sense of just how poor the poor in Egypt really are. These people crowding into an alley on an early Cairo morning this month are not, for the most part, unemployed. In fact, many of them are civil servants who probably live near one of the numerous bakeries that sell round loaves of bread for 40 piastres, less than 8 cents each. But eight-penny bread would be an outrageous extravagance in these times. Their meager salaries are stretched so thin that they stand in line, sometimes for hours, to buy state-subsidized 5 piastre bread. Hosma, a 62-year-old woman, smiles shyly and says she doesn't understand why there were bread shortages recently. She doesn't keep up with the news as much as she'd like, not being able to read or write. But she knows that her earnings, less than a dollar a day, don't even come close to covering her basic needs.
Everyone is upset with the high prices. I work for £150 a month, and everything is so expensive now. People give me donations. That's how I get by. A few weeks ago, we couldn't find any bread, and there used to be fights. It's also bad quality bread.
For Egypt's poor, it's not just the indignity of the bread lines. Cooking oil is up, rice is up, and meat has long been a luxury item. The local press is filled with stories of how the economic crisis is affecting people. Civil servants are now depending on bribes to make ends meet. Young men are extorting protection money from small shops. One report even claims that the crisis is causing Egyptians to lose their legendary sense of humor. The pain is spreading around the region. In Tunisia and Morocco, where dissent is not tolerated, police have been deployed recently to quell food protests. In oil-rich Saudi Arabia, boycott campaigns sprang up to protest the soaring cost of staple foods. Poor people in Yemen are reportedly spending more than a quarter of their income on bread. Food experts are warning that prices are likely to stay high in the near term, and social unrest could turn into violence. Here in Egypt, Nile Delta textile workers rioted this month just as local elections were being held. Professor Joel Bainan at the American University in Cairo says there are many factors at play here. Some are particular to Egypt, such as corruption in the distribution of subsidized wheat. Others have international roots. He says Egypt still imports a substantial amount of wheat from the U.S.
The United States pays farmers price supports not to grow wheat in order to raise the price of wheat. A second thing, which is more recent, is that a large proportion of the grain grown in the United States in recent years is being redirected to biofuels. So that, too, takes grain off the market and makes the price higher.
Whatever the causes, the effects are painful. As of last month, inflation was running at 12% over the previous year, and that pain is being voiced on the street. There were a reported 222 strikes or job actions in 2006. That soared to 580 last year, and not just in the industrial sector. Doctors, university professors, and private sector workers are also protesting. Bainan says that should have the government worried.
This is the core of the educated, professional, middle class, which has been the political class throughout the 20th century in Egypt and until now as well. When these people consider job actions or collective protests of a significant magnitude, this is potentially big trouble for the government.
The government's response to the unrest has been to make modest adjustments. President Hosni Mubarak this month ordered the lifting of tariffs on certain imports, including rice and cooking oil, and a commission is considering boosting the minimum wage for the first time in nearly a quarter century. Critics say such measures will do little to reverse the fundamental pressures driving up food prices and anxiety levels in the Middle East. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. Our final installment takes us to Haiti, where the prime minister was ousted in the face of food riots that took the lives of 6 Haitians and a UN peacekeeper last week. From Port-au-Prince, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports on how the rising cost of food threatens to deepen instability in the poorest country in the hemisphere.
Demonstrators in Port-au-Prince chanted, "We're dying of hunger. The president is doing nothing." His palace was later stormed. A melee erupted. At least 40 people who had been shot during the 3 days of unrest were treated here. A trauma center run by Doctors Without Borders. A gunshot victim from the normal course of events in this violent city is wheeled from surgery in this hospital that has the only emergency room in the capital. Haitians are well acquainted with scarcity. Most people here live on just $2 a day. But it now takes nearly half that to buy a small container of rice. Eddie Anabi, special representative of the UN Secretary General, says the increasingly fragile state of the population is undermining Haiti's path to political stabilization.
Obviously, people who are hungry have no stake in stability. And if we cannot respond to some of their basic needs, I think all the progress we have made in the last 3 years will be at great risk.
Medical experts say the population at greatest risk is Haiti's children. Here in the basement canteen of St. Vincent de Paul Primary School, children dig into plates heaping with beans and rice, supplemented with vitamins. In this student body of 2,100, only 1,300 are fed. Donors UNICEF and the World Food Program are falling behind in donations, unable to keep pace with the spiraling cost of rice that has hit $950 a ton, three times what it was at the start of 2007. Still, headmaster Elneuve Petit says his school has become a magnet for parents desperate to feed their children.
Now that we have the food program, enrollment has gone through the roof. We don't know where to put children. We don't even have problems of children not attending school, because once they know they're going to get this one single meal, they're coming.
The school lies in the slum of Cité Soleil. A man shovels mud from the street. Skipping school children in tidy gingham uniforms provide one of the few images of innocence and order. Men sit idle, no jobs, no prospects. Marie-Jo Joseph, a mother of seven, says her husband abandoned her and she cannot afford food. Feeding her children a meager meal of rice, she says, is like having them drink bleach. Even if we buy a small tin of rice and cook it for all the children, it's so little, she says. It doesn't do anything for their hunger. It only cleans and washes their stomach. At a nearby hospital, Dr. Franz Pierre from the NGO Doctors of the World says people are posing as patients on days the hospital distributes food to those in its care. He says more children are being admitted for malnutrition and more pregnant women are showing up anemic. He calls it a time bomb.
Anything can happen. There's no job, there's no food, we have sicknesses. We have almost everything.
Apart from the conventional explanations for the global food inflation, drought and too much corn and soy diverted to produce biofuels, Haiti has its own complications. Economist Claude Beaubœuf says this Caribbean nation opened its market to imported food that flooded in, choking off national production. He calls it
the boomerang effect of savage neoliberalization, and we're paying the price of that.
President René Préval has cut the price of rice 15% and plans more local production. Lifelong Cité Soleil resident Stéphane Pierre calls the measures too little too late as he clutches a bag of precious greens. These are just leaves that I got to boil with corn, but I don't have the money to buy the corn, he says. We're in a hole and have no voice. But the U.S., Canada, and France are speeding more aid to Haiti, while the country accelerates the search for a new prime minister. The United Nations, meanwhile, warns of more tense times across the globe, as high commodity prices show no signs of falling. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
For more international coverage, listen to your local NPR station, which you can find at npr.org. And while you're there, click on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.